At that stage, Gerry Adams and myself looked quite similar. We had to go for controversial guests and content, otherwise I didn't get paid. It was much the same having conversations with Richard Park on XFM about what was alternative.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Martin Campbell.
Radio had a great part in my life when I was a kid, but it was very strange because at that point you never ever thought about radio as a career. It was just something that was really good fun. Because my father had a tape recorder, I used to do things like turn the volume down on boxing matches and do my own commentary and then play them back and that sort of thing, and buy great big radios and radiograms and do them up, which wasn't great in a council house in Wisbeach. It wasn't particularly easy. So I loved all that, but I never thought about it as a career at all, because radio was something that other people did in the 50s. You know, it wasn't something, you know, to which you would aspire, so I didn't. I used to listen to all the things that make you sound like an old fart, you know, Beyond Our Ken and Round the Horn and Clitheroe Kid and all that Navy Lark and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, I think it's amazing now so many internet stations playing these things back to back 24 hours a day. It plays strange things with your mind, all that. But yeah, you used to love all that. Always did like radio, and still do, because particularly when you look at the sort of things that you now can hear on some radio stations and through the internet on radio stations, and then see the sort of stuff that you see on television, you can see why so many people are radio fans.
Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian, and this is my friend Sandy.
I left school early. That's a story of my life, really. I was let go at 15 because I had a job with the Wisbeach Advertiser, a fine August organ, and used to work there at weekends and in the evenings and that sort of thing. So I had a job to go to, which in Wisbeach was quite something. I was quite a celebrity. So I did. I left at 15 and worked for the Wisbeach Advertiser. And I'd always wanted to be a reporter because I thought it was different and you could meet lots of interesting people and go to places that you wouldn't otherwise go to, and I was right, and so I loved it, and I stayed in newspapers for some years in East Anglia, and also did a bit in London. And one of my prized possessions is a letter from the Daily Sketch. Any poor old sods listening there who remember the Daily Sketch. Daily Sketch,
in its never-ending search for happy readers, the Daily Sketch goes everywhere, sees everything.
I'm from the Daily Sketch. Sorry about that.
It was a tabloid before, I think, probably the word tabloid was used. And I had been covering a court in Chatteris, which is near Wisbeach. And there was a farmer with a dangerous dog. And that was the charge, having a dangerous dog. And when the magistrate said, you know, how do you plead? And he said, well, I'm not guilty, I'll show you. And he walked out. And of course, there was no policeman with an arm on his shoulder. So he walked out of the court and came back with this dog that looked the fiercest thing I had ever seen. It looked as if it ought to be in a circus or a zoo or both. And it was pulling at this great big chain that he'd put on it. And he said, there, nothing wrong with my dog. And then the dog flew over the magistrate's bench and pinned the magistrate down. Then a couple of policemen did appear and pulled the dog off. And it was absolute right. It was like Carry On Constable. But it made for a good story. And I thought, I know, I'll try and sell this to somebody. I'm selling a story, which is great. It's the first one I'd sent. And I sent it to the Daily Sketch, and they sent me a letter, which I've still got, sad person that I am, that offers me the job as the stringer for East Anglia. And of course, the next thing the Daily Sketch did was go bust.
And so ends another interview by the Daily Sketch, the paper that isn't afraid to make fun of anyone or anything, not even afraid to laugh at itself.
Life in newspapers was fantastic. I loved it. I worked for EMAP, actually, of course now Bauer, and did my apprenticeship with EMAP, and have even the EMAP journalist code book somewhere from the late 60s. And it was lovely because I was a kid and I was working with lots of other kids, and we would think of nothing of, you know, getting a call at 2 a.m. and going, doing the story and being at work again at 8 a.m. And we just had a great time, a really good time. And then, of course, when I was working, the newspaper was only just going on to web offset from Hot Metal. And then a lot of newspapers were still on Hot Metal. I worked at the Western Daily Press in Bristol. That was Hot Metal for years after most newspapers had changed. But the sort of camaraderie of young reporters is something that would be very difficult, I think, to bring back now, particularly with work practices and this sort of thing. We just loved it, and we would do anything to get the story. We wouldn't fabricate, we would get the story, and we would feel good about getting stories. And now when I go around newspapers and see the way that they are now, it is an entirely different life, an entirely different life. I worked in newspapers until around about 72-73, and finished up as news editor of the Suffolk Free Press, I think, in Sudbury. Then moved on. I'd always liked Lonnie Donegan. And one of the things that being a reporter did, and working for newspapers like the Peterborough Evening Telegraph, which just loved showbiz, you know, I could say, I want to go and meet Lonnie Donegan. Excellent, go on then. And so off you go. And you meet Lonnie Donegan. This is great. You know, I mean, I've never had a proper job. And it's been wonderful. And Lonnie actually for years became a friend. And then I gave up newspapers for a year to try and do Donegan's act. Not with a much degree of success, I have to say.
Sweet 16 goes to church just to see the boys.
I sang and did the clubs that were akin to the sort of Wheel Tappers and Shunters club, you know, the real Hot Pies Have Arrived clubs. And what that did do is actually with the reporting as well, it made you be able to face absolutely any audience at all. You know, when you've faced the Batley Variety audience on a Friday night and tried to sing to them, you can face any audience. And that actually was great. It was a great experience for later on in the career. That's why I've always liked to do presentations and this sort of stuff.
The opening today of the London Broadcasting Company's station marks a new departure in British broadcasting. It's the first station of the Independent Broadcasting Authority's local radio service, and the first all-news radio station in this country.
Commercial radio had only just started up with LBC, and I had been away when that... I'd been out of the country singing when that happened. And I'd never thought about small radio stations. Radio was round the horn, you know, and Clitheroe Kid and that sort of stuff. And so I looked into it, and Pennine in Bradford was one of the, well, I think it was the first small station to set up in 74, 75, something like that. I found out a little bit about it, went up and I met Tony Cartledge, who was the news editor there, and we got on very well. I think it was mainly through, we both quite liked horse racing, because I remember during the interview we were both looking at our watches in a very sort of embarrassed way, until one of us said, you know, is it the race that you're thinking about? And I said, yes, it is. So we whipped across then to the TV. So we got on, I got the job there, and started work at Pennine. And again, you know, it's a bit sad to see how the atmosphere of a station like Pennine, which was very much like newspapers, you know, you would do anything for the radio station. You would do anything to make sure that the radio station, which sounded good and got the story and got the listeners, and people worked their butts off there. And there were some very good people there, people like Stuart Francis, Steve Merrick, Peter Levy, I think it's still in that area. And Roger Kirk, bless him, Liz Allen, who'd been on Radio 2, Julius K. Scragg, who many people will have fond memories of.
Several minutes now past 6 o'clock, 7 past 6. It's must admit, it's nice to be the very first programme on the wireless. Right, first time in the morning.
On the news side, there was Steve Harris, who I didn't realise at the time, and he kept it very quiet, I didn't realise that he had effectively got the franchise himself. He'd worked at it himself. He was deputy news editor. Some lovely people.
This is Stephen Harris reporting.
First, there's grim news for the steel industry.
It was when you turned the key to turn the station on and turned it off at night, which is just so quaint now. That the whole idea of turning the station off, you know, like listen with mother. Bye-bye, station. Beep.
To Steve Merrick, 35.
Everybody did everything that they possibly could. They had a job to do and they did that, but they had lots of opportunities to do other stuff as well.
She makes me laugh, she makes me cry.
I was a reporter, but I also did the sort of equivalent of Children's Choice, I think 10 till 12 on a Saturday, the kids' request show. And I did specialist folk programmes with Austin Mitchell, the MP. Tops and Noils was the folk programme. And Austin used to do the very traditional finger in the ear stuff, and he used to love it. I mean, his sense of humour was just wonderful, and his collection of music was great. I would do the sort of slightly more modern stuff, like John Denver and Richard Digance, who was doing folk stuff at that time. Even got to play a few Lonnie Donegan records in it. But again, it was he really put his stamp on it, Austin. And it's remarkable the number of people in that area. He had problems with the IBA at the time because of his political affiliations as to whether he could, I think, become managing director of the station. I think he wanted to originally, but then couldn't. So he sort of helped and then became a presenter and so on. But we've stayed in touch over the years. But yeah, Tops and Noils. You don't hear that anymore. That's the stuff. That's the stuff.
So you're the man who gave us rhyme and reason.
You know, you just did whatever you wanted to do and whatever you wanted to suggest, if it was going to make the station better and sound bigger, and you would just do it. I know now that doesn't happen because so many of the things that Pennine did, nobody does anymore. Okay, and I know it wouldn't necessarily work anymore, but that sort of atmosphere was just superb. And again, people would work all night.
They thought they'd got him. I mean, one lad said to me, he said, well, you know, we think this is him, and took him away. Peter came back about 5 o'clock, and because we asked him what happened, they said that they'd interviewed him for the question of his whereabouts. And what
because in Bradford, not only was the Ripper raising his head, Richard Dunn was fighting his way to Muhammad Ali.
And of course, the champion of the world, defending his title for the 16th time, the great Muhammad Ali, getting ready for the introductions here.
So I got to know Richard, went to all the fights, did commentary on at the Albert Hall when he won the European Championship. And then when he fought Muhammad Ali in Munich, did the commentary for that, which was the first commercial radio commentary on a World Heavyweight Championship. For me, I think I made a right cock of it, to be honest, because you can only do these things well when you do them over and over again. And it was a big thing to do, World Heavyweight Championship commentary. And yeah, I probably didn't do it very well. But that's symptomatic of this. No. You like the boxing. You've met Richard Dunn now. You do the fights. No, you do the World Heavyweight Championship. Fantastic.
Magic 301.
Pennine was a lovely station to work on. Now called the Pulse, of course. But Trent was a much bigger station, and I had the opportunity, and I've been very lucky, because at Trent, I mean, there were, again, lots of good people there, apart from Steve and Tony. The presenters there were a great bunch, people like Chris Baird and Guy Morris.
There you go, a musical medley from 1966 as we flash back in this hour. That's the sound of the Kinks, and they had three big hits in that particular year.
And Dale Winton, whatever happened to him. I seem to remember someone called Lloyd hanging around the place. I don't know what happened to him either. Lots of very, very good people. And I worked with a girl called Sue Ward, who was wonderful. And she's wonderful in that she could fix anything. Find anybody, fix it, persuade them to come on air. Really good like that. And I think I was called head of features, which meant I could do phone-ins. But also, the programme controller at the time, Neil Spence, who I later worked with at the National Broadcasting School, quite an eccentric, became a very, very good friend.
Fine, yes, lovely. 25 minutes past the hour of 1 o'clock right now, and we've got a climber for you.
He allowed me to do, just to do stuff. So I had a one-hour program, which I think was called Trent Topic, and it was actually whatever I wanted to do. If there was something big in the news, we could cover that. If Monty Python had a new album out, then we could play a whole load of that. It was not quite sure what the ratings were like, because when it's only an hour long, you can hide, can't you? You can hide from the ratings.
Now, OK, that's a good enough excuse for not hearing it. Let's move on to it to other things. You were last in the charts over here with The Lion Sleeps Tonight back in 72.
Yes.
A song that was also a hit for other people earlier on, amongst them Carl Denver's Whim Away. Now, how do you get that voice? I mean, it's a very distinct voice, isn't it?
It's falsetto, of course. And
I mean, you don't talk anything like you sing.
No. If I did, I'd be in a lot of trouble.
I bet you would.
Yeah. I'd have some problems.
One of the things that we did at Trent that I will never forget is they applied for money to do a situation comedy. And Howard Imber, who wrote for the Two Ronnies, used to live near me in Waltham on the Wolds. And Bill Maynard, who was Selwyn Froggatt at the time, before Heartbeat, was there life before Heartbeat? This is how long ago it was. Bill Maynard lived close to us as well.
Why, you don't half look smart, Morris. You could have been wed by now if you hadn't been so shy.
So Howard Imber wrote a series called Cobblers, which was a nod to shoemaking in Nottingham, and Bill Maynard played the manager of a pop group. It was the only sitcom that's ever been specifically written for commercial radio, performed live, and had a wonderful time. And I produced that. Okay, there were mistakes in it, but some of it is very funny. Bill Maynard was very funny, but you could not stop him from the one joke everywhere. It'll surprise you to know we used to go and have a few drinks every now and again, but every pub we went in, of course, people would immediately recognise him, so the pub would go quiet, and he'd pick up the pint of beer, hold it up to the light and say, "This horse is not fit for work." And he just did it every time, and you just couldn't stop, and the pub would just fall about, and I'd think, "Oh my God, not again." I mean, the thing I learned from that was that audiences are sometimes too eager to please. They will laugh too heartily at jokes which weren't that funny. They were funny, but in context, they weren't that funny. And they have to tell people, just calm down.
You've been listening to Cobblers by Howard Imber, starring Bill Maynard as Vernon, with Jack Denman, Joy James, Maynard Williams, Boris Carlin, Phil Selby, Andy Keeley, Val Terry. Cobblers was produced for Radio Trent by Martin Campbell.
So, again, I was very lucky in that I could do different things, but things that were different. And that was lovely. So it's a marvellous time at Trent. And, of course, met my wife, Jan, at Trent, who was sales. But no, actually, there were a lot of relationships with radio stations at that time. But then again, of course, there were a lot more people there then. When I moved from Trent to BRMB in Birmingham, I think there were 8 engineers at BRMB. Well, I mean, that's just farcical now if you look around. A chief engineer and a deputy chief engineer and this and that, and 8 engineers. Marvellous. So lots of people. Lots of people. But very, very good, very good time at Trent. Enjoyed that. It's funny with relations. Adrian, my stepson, sort of hung around with me one week, probably no school, and thought this was marvellous, because I had one week where I met Roy Orbison, and he came round to my house. Let's take Roy Orbison home. I interviewed him, and the interview went okay. And I said to him afterwards, "Why does everyone tell me that you don't like doing interviews and you give one word answers?" He said, "Oh, they just think because I wear dark glasses that I'm not very nice." And it turned out he was having a really miserable time. And I said, "Do you know what I've got at home? I've got an old songbook of yours," because I used to try and do his songs as well. "I've got an old songbook of yours with wearing clear glasses, all posed horribly. Roy plays pool, posed badly. Roy on motorbike, and you can see the stand on the motorbike." He had terrible things. And I was explaining this to him. Well, he said, "Oh, that's great. I'd love to see that." So I said, "Oh, I'll go home and get it." And he said, "Oh, can I come with you?" Yes, Latimer Drive has not seen the light. I said, yeah, sure. Why? He says, why is that? What do I see? I see clubs and I see car parks and I see hotels. And of course, it is true when you go abroad. How often do you actually go into anyone's house? You don't, do you? However long you're abroad, very often, you never go to anyone's house. So it's marvellous. Just to take Roy Orbison now. So I had a day with Roy Orbison that I'll never forget.
I was all right. For a while, I could smile for a while.
But also, I used to do some of the sort of open line phone-ins where people would ring up with problems and then you try and get the counsellor on the phone and, the sort of thing. And my father was over one day and we sat him in the master control room and he watched me do this sort of open line phone-in because he couldn't understand what I did for a living. I mean, he couldn't understand when I was on newspapers, but this was really baffling. And so he watched the phone-in go out and then after... I went through and said, well, what did you think of that? He said, oh, that's very interesting. What do you do? I said, well, no, you've seen what I do. He said, what do they pay you for? I said, no, they pay me to do that. But because, he'd never heard commercial radio in his life, it was completely baffling. I mean, maybe the programme was baffling. But, Trent was a lovely time. And, of course, that also, the medium wave was the one that was plugged then. Even then, it was 301. I couldn't tell you what the VHF was. 96.2. My father was a lecturer, and I've always been interested in the sort of cogs and the wheels behind things. So I was always interested in what the IBA did. I never thought I'd finish up working for the Radio Authority and Ofcom, but yeah, I was always interested in that area of it. Because it was my view at the time that there wasn't much need for most of this regulation. And I think I was probably right, to be honest. But yeah, I was always interested in that and the training bit as well. And I got involved in training much later on. But I've also tried to bounce between doing it and talking about it, actually being hands-on and then lecturing or whatever, or regulating as well. And I tried to bounce back within the industry. I've always been cheesed off by the people in lecturing and indeed regulation who either used to do it years ago and you're supposed to take notice of what they say. So I really tried to keep all the balls juggling at the same time, if that makes sense. Money prompted the move to BRMB, I seem to think, and also the fact that they were going to give me a nice car and create a position called Head of Talks, which was quite bizarre when you think, oh, I'm Head of Talks. But it meant that, I could do phone-ins and documentaries and features, and I did the sort of news programme and so on. So I've always tried not to be pigeonholed in commercial radio, just doing reporting or just doing presenting and that sort of thing. And being Head of Talks at BRMB at that time was just fantastic because the people that you had round you made BRMB such a strong brand, and to drive a BRMB liveried car around, never once vandalised, never once. You had Ed Doolan there doing superb phone-ins, you had Tony Butler doing sport. Tony was just fantastic. I used to do a programme that followed his, and if it was a news thing and I wanted to sort of actually take a couple of minutes and be a couple of minutes late, I could just shout to Tony if he could fill for 2 minutes. Well, Tony Butler could fill for half an hour with no notice whatsoever. And I listened back to a tape once when I'd asked him to fill for a couple of minutes, and it just sort of went like, well, this is Tony Butler, of course, and you know the sort of things that I talk about, and you know what I've said in the past, and you know what's come true now, and you heard it here first. And it just went on and on. There's absolutely nothing coming up for 2 minutes, and in the end, it was Tony Butler, BRMB. And wonderful. I've never heard the like of it before or since.
Welcome back. Well, we're opening the lines. 021-359-4011. That'll get you to me. Any comments, opinions you want to express about the world of sport, we'd be very pleased indeed to hear from you. Anything at all you want to chat about.
Les Ross, of course, the master of breakfast. I mean, it really was a superb station. And having said that, I think the people of Birmingham appreciated it as well. It was very, very well supported. And again, with some freedom. And also, yeah, a documentary unit on hand as well. Can you imagine that?
10 o'clock this evening on BR&B, we've got a programme called Open Line, presented by John Austin. And there are sometimes calls from girls who are expecting a baby and need help. In Open Line tonight, John Austin will be hearing from Lifeline. That's an organisation that offers help to girls who are pregnant. And that's just one of the topics in tonight's Open Line programme. Because you stay in touch.
If you talked to anyone on the street, if you wanted to do a vox pop and you had BR&B on your microphone, normally on a radio station you walk down the street, you know, with a microphone and you sort of push it in front of people, you know, it's like a leper coming their way and, you know, they all scatter. But with BR&B it would be quite the opposite. They would all come and they'd start singing jingles over the top. And it was just such good fun. But at BR&B, people just loved the brand. It made them happy. Ed Doolan's programme in particular did help real people with real things. I got the opportunity while I was at BR&B to actually do training full time, which I had done now and again, sort of whipping up to London, going to other radio stations and training reporters and so on. And the National Broadcasting School, I had the opportunity to go and be head of news there. And Neil Spence, the original programme director at Mercury when I'd been there, was there teaching presenters, and in quite an eccentric way, but indeed with an awful lot of success. The National Broadcasting School was funded by what was called secondary rental when radio stations made money. If they made too much money, then it was effectively taxed by the regulator, and the money put back into the industry, which is a very good idea, for people to do things. And one of the things that was funded was the National Broadcasting School. Also, IRN's political unit, I think, was funded through it. And individual stations were given funding to do things if they put forward good ideas. But so, yes, National Broadcasting School was fantastic, because Michael Bucht, who was Michael Barry, the TV chef, was the sort of head of it.
Pinch of salt, and off we go.
Julie Hill, who lovely lady who ran Women's Radio Group, was my deputy. So Neil Spence was there. John Russell joined us later on. We trained some good people there. But I shall never forget how Michael used to. He kept his appearances to a minimum for best effect.
Something like 3,000 people went through its doors. It was validated as the one of the earliest journalistic organisations to teach radio, and half the programme controllers in the country now are graduates, which is really nice.
He would come in and there would be lots of students. Some of them already had jobs at ILR stations, and some of them had paid to come on the course. There was a mix of people, and Michael would come in on the first day to bluster in and with his big fedora, and they'd say, what are you all doing here? What do you want to do? What do you want to do? Where do you want to be? Where are you going? What do you want to be? You. And they'd all sort of give answers that were a bit like beauty contests, you know, I want to look after children and ride horses and this sort of things. And they'd say, well, you know, I want to be a reporter and blah, blah, blah. And then Michael would bang the table and he'd say, don't any of you want to meet bloody good people and have a bloody good time? And he really used to enthuse people, and that was his thing. And he's actually quite right, because you know, I've never really wanted a proper job, and I've always had a nice time. And I think he gave people that sort of perspective. But so National Broadcasting School was very good fun, and I've found as well that when you face a room full of people who want to be reporters and are reporters and so on, you really have to think about what you're doing to a very healthy degree. I think a lot of reporters get things out of perspective, probably even people like John Humphreys. You know, they get things out of perspective. Every now and again, you step back and you explain, why is that story top? Why isn't that story top? Why are we carrying on that story and getting another angle out of it? Why aren't we just dropping it? And you think as you become a more professional reporter, things become automatic to you. But when someone actually stops you and says, right, stop, why are you interviewing him? Why aren't you interviewing her? Why are you doing it that way? Why not do it that way? Training actually makes you do that. And I think it doesn't make you a better reporter. I wish more people would do it. When I was chairman of the Broadcast Journalism Training Council, I was privileged to go around and see lots and lots of courses. I used to worry, actually, that some of them were almost too good, that you had everything there. You have everything on a plate. I'm afraid I'm one of these people who worried when editing became digital. You know, I still think that if you're going to chop a tape, you think twice about whether you chop it there. If you've got a digital 20 seconds that you can just lift off, then the temptation is to lift it off and not to think actually about editing. So I think a lot of digital editing is not actually editing. It strikes me that as someone who got into journalism training, I think it's very sad that most journalists are very good at processing stories, but hopeless at actually generating them. And I think that's a great sadness. And that's in radio and TV as well, I think. I think, the generation of news is lost. Because, I look around and say, having seen so many courses, and then you still listen to something like Radio 4, and just recently, the train strikes, and lots of very good human stories about people, having a real problem at home because they don't get home to see the kids before they go to bed, have problems with the job because the boss doesn't believe that they can't get into work. These are real human stories. Radio 4 the other day had the same vox pop in the morning and lunchtime and in the evening. Well, that's absolutely disgraceful given what is at their disposal. But this is the main news station. You think, well, what are people doing? Yeah, this is the main story. They're still using the same vox pop in the Today programme and PM. And it's complete nonsense. So, I worry about the perspective sometimes.
Well, let me ask you the question again, if I may. Why 33 out of the 50 journeys that the Times logged, why could they get a cheaper fare than that which was offered?
The broadcasting school did end, yeah. Well, radio stations stopped making money and then so they didn't have any profit. So the IRN parliamentary unit was bought up by ITM because that was the only way that they could get parliamentary audio. So they had to have that, and the NBS went down the pan. And I moved on then to Falmouth and ran a radio journalism course down there, which I was very, very happy to be at. It's a lovely place, Cornwall. Taught some wonderful people down there. We're also the first course to have a news car, sponsored news car. It used to baffle the tourists because they were forever tuning their radios to try and find Radio Falmouth, which of course they couldn't at that stage. It's well before Tinterweb. One of my little success stories was Fiona Phillips, who had no experience before the MBS. And I'd gone round doing the sort of Michael Buck, what do you want to be? And she said, oh, I want to be TV correspondent in LA. The others didn't actually guffaw, but you could see that they were sort of holding back, oh yeah, and the rest of it. And she worked like stink and did so well, and of course finished up as the LA reporter, and then fronted up TVAM.
Life's big things have happened to me since I've been here, and my mum has died, I've got married, I've had two children, my dad's very ill now, and throughout you have supported me so much, I cannot tell you. I've spent hours in my dressing room, sorry, just crying over your letters and cards, so thank you so much, it's been such a privilege just sharing my mornings with you.
But I was particularly pleased when she did do that because on the BBC was Juliette Morris on the sofa of the BBC, and I trained her at Falmouth. So when one of the Sundays picked up the story of the two girls on the two main stations.
The Real Radio News at 10. This is Magnus Carter. Mrs. Thatcher's meeting with Lech Walesa today is expected to spark further controversy.
GWR were very brave, A, because they hired me, but also they were very brave because we'd gone past the point where people in radio couldn't work out whether the listener was mainly on VHF or medium wave. They'd got to that part and they'd split the signal, which the regulators had allowed them to do, and they had Brunel Radio on AM and GWR on FM. And they started an experiment to have different news as well. So Brunel was a slightly older audience, so they'd have a slightly older targeted news. It was very brave, and it worked as far as the listener was concerned, but it wasn't viable. And that's a great shame. It was certainly very, very good to do it, and made for an interesting atmosphere within the station of Brunel and GWR, because, yes, they were sort of in opposition a bit, but you put your resources together. So people like Mike Henfield, who was there at the time, and Ralph Bernard, they deserve a good pat on the back for trying that, because I think it worked as far as the listener was concerned, but it just wasn't viable. GWR was very forward thinking, and the split news is a demonstration of that. But I don't think anybody thought that they were ready to rule the world at that point. It was still very much sort of, you know, in Dave Cash's shadow and that sort of thing. So when I left GWR after that experiment to go to Mercury, yes, that's when they as soon as I left, yes, they started their rise. It's a bit like the Daily Sketch, really, isn't it? Mercury merged with County Sound, and there were various ways that the cards were dealt, of Mercury being in Guildford and Crawley and County Sound being the AM in both areas and so on. And then we had a station called Fortune AM in Manchester. And then at that point, Mercury's AM was called Fame, I think. It was just so that you could have fame and fortune, I think. A bit bizarre. Just like we always wanted a mast in Dorking so we could have a programme called Talking Dorking. So, yeah, that went well. That was my first taste of the higher radio management. And when I started to discover that it's a bit like nursing, the higher you get, the further you get taken away from the patients. Managing presenters is never easy. It's difficult, but it's good. It's good training, and I always enjoyed it. I always enjoyed managing good people. Funnily enough, I think I was a reasonable talent manager, because I mean, years later at Talk Radio, when you were having to manage people like David Starkey, that's when you need to pull out some aces from your sleeve. And I think I like to think that I learned how to do that now and again. But yeah, the music side of it, to be honest, I found a bit dull, and I got cheesed off just arguing with people, you know, who said, well, you know, no, you have to play this record every couple of hours, because otherwise, you know, people won't know what sort of station you are, and you have to, blah. I mean, it never really interested me that much, and I'm not even sure how much it interests listeners, really. You know, I think if you have a sound and stick to it, then that's what you do. I think you can over research, you know, just as a chef can. You know, a chef can do so much that the whole thing becomes ridiculous, when actually all you want is a good meal. And I think a lot of radio stations try to do that. After Mercury, I went to Holland to do some international training, and that's good as well, because it opens your eyes. And you know, when you're talking to people in some African countries, you know, about how to cover stories, knowing full well that if the president doesn't like it, you know, your family's probably going to get it. I mean, it really is interesting. And so international training was nice. And then I got a call from John Amonier, who was the managing director at Radio Mercury originally, and then went on to Talk Radio and Virgin and so on, who got me involved in Talk Radio, I think, after it had sort of grown up from its shock jock thing and was a little bit rudderless, I think, in terms of speech. And it was the time when John Major resigned, and so there was an opportunity to actually start to show what sort of station it was, because it was a good political story, and I went in to help cover that. And eventually, after John left and Jason Bryant took over, he took me on as managing editor.
Goodbye, England's rose. May you ever grow in our hearts. You were the grace that placed us
myself where lives were torn apart.
We had things like the death of Diana, and yeah, suddenly you really are having to think about what to do. And I can remember the first thing that I thought was right, you know, no conspiracy calls, you know, for at least a week. You know, James Whale got into a lot of controversy about whether the coffin should be on the gun carriage and so on, but it sparked off a big national debate. And that was an amazing time when you really can provide a platform for people to say something and to vent their feelings.
Talk Radio UK. It's the talk of the nation.
It was absolutely fantastic. Some wonderful memories of that. Not least of all, remember James Whale, a good old pro, and there were some really good pros at Talk at one stage. We managed to organise hustings for the election. It had been in 97, and it hadn't been done that way before with every single leader there, including James Goldsmith, you know, all the way through Paddy Ashdown and Blair and Major, and also Gerry Adams. And at that stage, Gerry Adams and myself looked quite similar in that we had dark hair, sort of dark greying beards, and very similar glasses. And I had to go and get Gerry Adams from the Today studios, which were around the corner. We were in Oxford Street in Talk Radio, BBC studios around the corner, obviously. And I had to go and get Gerry Adams straight from the Today programme to the Talk studios. And I remember James Wells shouting down the corridor. I said, tell him to look out for short-sighted snipers. Because when we got Gerry Adams in the IRA mobile shooting down Oxford Street, I related this story to him. He said, oh, yes, you're quite right. I hadn't thought about that. You're quite right. Short-sighted snipers, yes. And then we came to a roadblock on Oxford Street. I mean, about 3 minutes to airtime. And there's a roadblock and a policeman there. I said, oh, no. So put the window down. And I said, I've got to get Gerry Adams to the studios in Talk just up there. And he looked in and he saw Gerry Adams and pulled the roadblock aside so we could go through. And I thought, well, this is a bizarre world we live in. You know, you said, to all intents and purposes, this terrorist is sitting in the car. Well, that's fine. Let him through. You know, so he's there for Talk. But, that was good fun, too. I enjoyed all that.
Talk Radio UK.
Caesar the Geezer.
Listen, I've been hearing about you for the last 8 months from my sister-in-law, Julie.
Yeah.
And all I get is...
They didn't like me. Because I think they thought that I'd been put in there to try and stop them having a good time. And they were having a good time, but it didn't sound very good. And in a way, I think that they were quite right. That really was sort of part of my job. Later, of course, when it all changed hands and the new people came in and John Amonier disappeared, the new people all thought I was part of the old regime, and the old people had thought I was, you know, I was the new regime. I'd been heading up the new regime. So I never belonged to anyone there, which was quite useful. It really was quite useful. That is where you do learn to manage talent. But most of it was fantastic. And also, you know, getting people on air. You know, we've got Neil and Chris and Dean Hamilton to do the breakfast show when they were... There was a particularly weird story going on about them, and we got them to do breakfast. And Mike Dickin, I remember as well, is a legend of phone-in radio. And in fact, I'm sure his wife won't mind me saying this, but James Whale, when Mike, bless him, was killed in a car smash, and James Whale did a program of remembering Mike Dickin. And it was a jolly program. It was a celebration, and I helped him on the program. And then so halfway through the program, we realised that virtually everything had been drink related that we knew from Mike. But it was such a nice guy. And James recounts the story. He says, because if presenters had a problem, then it was normally my job to sort them out. And James was saying, I could hear Mike on the phone to you saying, Martin, I have a bit of a problem here, and I think it's a 3-bottle lunch. And Talk would, I think, one or two things needed to have been done, but I think it would have been a great success had it carried on But Kelvin took it in a different direction, made it very successful, and now there's another talk on DAB.
I am going to do the longest piece of verbal Angora knitting that this radio station has ever seen. I've got to tell you that the only way that this is going to be is the way that it is.
Yeah, we brought in a couple of people to do one-offs. I mean, we brought in Jonathan King at one stage to do a programme, Trevor MacDonald. David Starkey was particularly interesting, and I love David Starkey.
I think, in fact, the whole principle of universal human rights is an absurdity. Rights are conditioned by individual cultures and by individual periods. I mean, you've only got to think of...
I mean, you actually had to sort of metaphorically pin him up against the wall every now and again and say, for Christ's sake, David, people are not at all intellectually as gifted as you are. You know, allow them to hit you once or twice. You know, even Muhammad Ali did that. You know, it's not a fight if you just go in and flatten them. Right. We did things that were different, like Mandy Allwood with the multiple births. She did a programme. We got a lot of stick for that. But, you know, it was interesting. And part of my salary was actually based on getting publicity and national mentions for the radio station. So, you know, I had to. We had to go for controversial guests and content. Otherwise, I didn't get paid.
And I'm no musical expert. I couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. In fact, the day the music died, they took my voice in for questioning.
And Paul Ross was there. I'm a particular fan of Paul Ross. I think he's very funny. And I can remember saying to Paul Robinson when I left to go to the Radio Authority, Paul shouted down. Paul Ross shouted down to Paul Robinson, "Ah, what are you going to do now, Paul? He's turned copper's narc." I thoroughly loved working at the Radio Authority. Then the title, I think, was as yours, Director of Programming and Advertising. And it certainly did give you a good perspective on UK radio. It was the opportunity. Do you know, I felt I wanted to do it. And it is one of these jobs, and you know, David, that everyone in radio will say to you, "I'd love to do your job for a week or a day, or, you know, sit and take your phone calls and, you know, talk to the people that you talk to." And I wanted to do that, so I was really pleased. Mostly dealing with complaints and the sore point of whether stations were, you know, within their promise of performance or, you know, within their format. And I tend to think, I don't know whether you would agree, but that whole thing has been over-regulated. But unfortunately, you've got to go on as you started with regulation. So, you know, you can't say, "Oh, well, you know, we've changed it overnight because it needs, you know, whole new laws and that sort of stuff." I did read John Meyer's book, because after the Radio Authority, I went to Ofcom, and I read John Meyer's book about his dealings with the regulator on Jazz FM and whether it's got trumpets or not, whether it's jazz. And it was much the same, having conversations with Richard Park on XFM about what was alternative. And I think we agreed over one lunch that, yeah, probably George Formby would be regarded as alternative. But it depends on the circumstances, doesn't it? Yeah, so you get to know everybody in radio, which I also did enjoy. And I just loved the idea of going from radio station to radio station and meeting people. I got the impression that it tends to go in waves, and radio stations, you know, one will have an outrageous competition, so another one will have an outrageous competition until, you know, something really badly goes wrong, you know, when people can get hurt. And it does happen. And radio is an incredible force. And I always regulated thinking that the microphone is a very, very strong weapon to wield around. There is an area of dealing with people's emotions, and whether it's wind-up calls or competitions, you know, telling people that they've won something and they haven't, or they have and they, you know, all this nonsense.
The Broadcasting Act gives us a number of sanctions. We can impose a correction or an apology, or we can impose a fine, or we can shorten a licence, or we can revoke a licence. These are fairly extreme measures, and we mostly find that simply by publishing complaints in our quarterly complaints bulletin, that's enough to deter companies from making the same mistake again. They don't like humiliation.
I always felt actually that there was a need for somebody there, not so much with the language thing, because that's normally a mistake. Or someone has gone too far. No one normally sets out to use bad language all the time. But a lot of these things with competitions and wind-up course, I always felt that actually it did need somebody there to say, hey, whoa. If this sort of thing becomes the norm, then people are going to get hurt. And it has happened. It has happened a few times. So, you know, while I think there has been a lot of over-regulation, I do think that there is a need for regulation for normal, if you take my meaning, radio. I know we live in a different age now with internet radio and so on, but there is a style of radio that people want to be able to turn on and know the sort of boundaries that they're going to meet. And so, you know, I do think that there's a need. On the question of awarding licences, the idea of a beauty contest never really appealed to me, because people would clearly push the envelope as far as they possibly could. And in some areas, the legislation would effectively say, well, if they don't do that, and they don't even attempt to do it, it doesn't really matter, because it's not relevant within the legislation. So they can say, well, we're going to employ, you know, X number of people, and we're going to have, you know, so many phone-ins and so on. And then if they don't do it, the answer is, oh, well, no, you can't actually pin them down to that. You can only pin them down to this, this, and this. And so the license award system was simplified a little under Ofcom, but not half as simple as I wanted it. Mind you, there aren't any licences, so it doesn't really matter that much. There were some awarded at Ofcom under those procedures, and I found it was a bit... I thought that was a bit silly. But normally these things end up, once the dust settles, they end up half sensibly. Only half. The transition to Ofcom was very strange, because you also had the Broadcasting Standards Commission, and you had BT and so on. And I finished up as chief advisor, started off as head of radio, and I finished up as chief advisor. I don't think they liked my management style much. So I became chief advisor, which is quite nice, because it meant, again, a bit like going back to the BR&B and Trent days, you could wander around from room to room and person to person and get a flavour of what's going on and help if there's an area that you can help in. So that's what I did. But the regulator is massive, because it looks after the post office and broadband and all this sort of stuff. It is far more like a bunch of civil servants than the radio authority was, because that was the people who liked radio, the ITC, the people who understood TV. I didn't get the passion, apart from one or two people who are still there, but not at the top. I never got the impression at the top that there was much passion for radio or TV. Now, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe Ofcom should be able to, on Wednesday, we regulate widgets instead of radio and TV. Maybe that's fine. Maybe that's good. But it wasn't really for me in that respect. I enjoyed my time there, but as a big, big regulator of, you know, what is a little industry, really, radio, there's almost an incongruity there. After Ofcom, I started to do a lot of television work, and a lot of the work is with Media Objectives, with Bob Tyler's Media Objectives, and that's been incredibly enjoyable. We're working with people who do things like the sex channels and the psychics and the religious channels and people like this. I mean, they're amazing people. And of course, they're the people who do the content that's likely to fall foul of the regulator. And it's a shame that in radio, I don't do an awful lot of radio work, because not an awful lot of people in radio do things. They're not going to do anything wrong. So that's me out of a job for a start. My most enjoyable spell would be at talk radio, simply because that's really what I wanted to do. The music side, you know, didn't really appeal. We had in the early days of Mercury put together license application, and I can't remember, People Power was the name of it, People Power. And it was wonderful. Cynthia Payne was going to do the problem page. Buster Edwards was going to do the gardening, because he sold flowers outside the town. At least people had agreed. We'd been to see them. The guy at Ford Open Prison who'd been done for fraud was going to do the finance programme. It was just going to be wonderful. And it was going to be people wandering around London with backpacks, which, of course, could be done with mobile phones now. And it was actually way before its time. It was a bit tongue-in-cheek. We never thought we would get it. I remember it was a London franchise, and the Guardian did a little article on all the applications for the London franchise. And all it said for this one was, whoever wrote it is on drugs. But, you know, we'd actually had fun putting that together, but there was still something there, a platform. And when talk radio came on, it was good to be able to provide a platform for national speak. So the time at talk was fantastic. It was almost going back to the early days of newspapers when, you know, I would get calls at 1 or 2 in the morning and have to make decisions on what to do. And you were never off duty, and the presenters were exactly the same, and that was the sort of camaraderie, because it was new, and everyone wanted it to succeed.
That dictator, by the way, we sold 40 million quid's worth of military vehicles to him in the 90s. Right, we will end up bombing the very stuff we flogged to them.
When talk radio sold out to Kelvin, I spoke to Kelvin a few times, and indeed know him quite well. And he has said sometimes, you know, I wonder what would have happened if I'd have let it stay as it was, as talk. But anyway, he took it as sport, and he was quite right. I mean, it was a brave decision, Prime Minister. I mean, it was a brave decision to take it that way. I think talk, there is a place for talk radio, and I think it would have cost a fair amount to have allowed talk to go forward and succeed, and whether the feeling was that they didn't want to put that amount of money in, maybe that was it. But nevertheless, I think the channel that it started to dig after the first few months, I think it is an excellent way. You know, it works in America, and you know, it doesn't have to be the shock jock. We showed that it doesn't have to be your shock jock programs. But I suppose, you know, we'll never know unless this new talk comes on. It's got Paul Ross on breakfast. It's got some good people on it. You know, it needs listeners, and it needs exposure, and it needs promotion.
It's currently riding reasonably high in the charts over here and has sold an absolute bomb.
You know, it's from starting off in newspapers, as I say, I never wanted a proper job, never had one, and haven't got one. I mean, I don't think I'd like to be remembered in any particular way. I'd quite like to be remembered. Radio is always going to be around, and that special bit of radio that isn't just the internet and isn't the podcast, That will be around, probably in a different form. But I think people do appreciate now, as the internet grows and all the digital stuff grows, and you know, you carry screens around with you all the time. It's almost a novelty not to have something to do with your eyes. So I don't think it's ever going to disappear. Quite right too. I think it'll be as popular as ever, and I'm sure the word radio will still be used. You know, it's not going to be like, you know, the magic lantern. You know, do you remember that? It's never going to be like that. There'll always be the radio.
Martin Campbell. For more in this series, search Radio Moments Conversations in your podcast player.